Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 5th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast first thing, this one coming from KCRG. Winds ease up for Friday. Showers and storms could wrap up the weekend. After several blustery days, we catch a bit of a break to the end of the work and school week. Many parts of the area are starting out the day with a good amount of sunshine, though there is a patch of clouds affecting east-central Iowa. These clouds may start to slide to the southeast this morning, with additional scattered cloud development possible at times throughout the day. In general, though, you can expect at least more sunshine than the overcast days we've seen recently. Temperatures will warm a bit more today as a result, with highs headed for the upper 40s to mid-50s. The biggest change today, though, will be the decrease in wind speeds. After 2 days in a row where gusts were especially strong, speeds will only be about 5 to 15 miles per hour from the north or northeast during the day. This will help make for a more comfortable day, though the break will be fairly short-lived. The weekend starts out with temperatures in the upper 20s and mostly clear skies. Winds will be light initially on Saturday, but they'll increase throughout the day, leading to speeds of at least 15 to 25 miles per hour, with gusts pushing past 30 by late in the evening. Highs head for the 50s area-wide, with the warmest readings in the south and west. We'll see a modest increase in cloud cover late in the day on Saturday, too, with mostly cloudy skies by Saturday night. Showers and storm chances start to pick up later Saturday night, too, as a push of moisture works into the region. While severe weather appears to be unlikely, some heavier downpours are possible at times early on Sunday. Activity becomes a bit more scattered later in the day, but we can't rule out additional showers and storms until later on Sunday night. Temperatures hold pretty close to where they got on Saturday as a result of the influx of warmer and somewhat more moist air. Rainfall totals could run in the quarter-inch to half-inch range pretty easily with this system, which would continue to add up on top of the gains we've made over the past couple of weeks against our ongoing drought. While more work still needs to be done, it's good to see some of this wetter weather continuing for now. The same storm system that brings us rain chance on Sunday also will be the biggest player in whether we get clearing skies on Monday to see the partial solar eclipse in eastern Iowa. Based on the latest information, we've still got a shot, but it's not a guarantee. We characterize the forecast on Monday as partly cloudy overall. There does appear to be some indication that areas north of U.S. Highway 20 may end up cloudier than those to the south, which could limit the visibility of the partial eclipse there. In general, though, the forecast looks somewhat more favorable than in 2017, when widespread clouds and some rain made for difficult viewing conditions. Remember, though, that in most cases in eastern Iowa, you won't really notice a significant difference despite the sun being between 80% to 90% obscured by the moon. If you want to catch a glimpse of the eclipse, grab some ISO-compliant eclipse glasses or construct a pinhole projector to track its progress projected onto the ground or a flat surface. As far as regional conditions, there's some indication that conditions along the path of totality in southern Missouri, southern Illinois, and parts of Indiana could wind up with at least a decent shot at some clearing. This could also change over the next couple of days, and we'll be tracking it. There's a graphic here which shows the timing for the eclipse on Monday, and it says at 12:46 p.m., the partial eclipse begins, and by 2:02 p.m., there will be an 86% of the sunlight eclipsed, and by 3:16 p.m. on Monday, the partial eclipse will be all over. Continuing with the forecast for next week, temperatures will generally be warmer next week than this week, with highs potentially returning to the 60s for many as soon as Monday. Windy conditions could accompany this change early in the week. At least some sunshine appears possible too, which would still make for some rather comfortable days. The exception during the week will be in the middle of it, where a storm system moves close enough to our area that we'll see an influx in clouds. It also comes with a slim chance for some showers on Wednesday, though the risk of those has shown some signs of diminishing based on the latest data. Things could actually turn a little bit warmer by the start of the following weekend, with highs getting closer to 70. Now we turn to the front page of the Courier, and the top story is about the relationship between the United States and Israel. The headline says, Biden warns Israel, U.S. aid at risk. The president calls for steps to protect civilians and aid workers. And this story comes to us by way of the Associated Press. And the article begins with two side-by-side photographs. On the left, we see President Joe Biden, and on the right, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Dateline is Washington. President Joe Biden issued a stark warning to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Thursday that future U.S. support for Israel's Gaza war depends on the swift implementation of new steps to protect civilians and aid workers. Biden and Netanyahu's roughly 30-minute call just days after Israeli strikes killed 7 food aid workers in Gaza added a new layer of complication to the leaders' increasingly strained relationship. Biden's message marks a sharp change in his administration's steadfast support for Israel's war efforts, with the U.S. leader for the first time threatening to rethink his backing if Israel doesn't change its tactics and allow much more humanitarian aid into Gaza. The White House would not specify what could change about U.S. policy, but it could include altering military sales to Israel and America's diplomatic backup on the world stage. Administrative officials said they expected the Israelis to make announcements on next steps within hours or days, and that U.S. would then assess whether the Israeli moves go far enough. Biden, quote, made clear the need for Israel to announce and implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers, unquote. The White House said in a statement following the leader's call, quote, he made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps, unquote. Biden also told Netanyahu that an immediate ceasefire is essential and urged Israel to reach such an accord, quote, without delay, according to the White House, which described the conversation as direct and honest. There was no immediate reaction to the call from Israeli government. The leaders' conversation comes as the World Central Kitchen, founded by restaurateur José Andrés to provide immediate food relief to disaster-stricken areas, called for an independent investigation into the Israeli strikes that killed the group's staff members, including an American citizen. The White House said the U.S. has no plans to conduct its own investigation, even as it called on Israel to do more to prevent the harming of innocent civilians and aid workers as it carries out its operations in Gaza. Separately, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told reporters in Brussels that U.S. support would be curtailed if Israel doesn't make significant adjustments to how it's carrying out the war. Quote, if we don't see the changes that we need to see, there will be changes in our policy, he said. White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby echoed the call for tangible and concrete changes to be taken by the Israelis beyond reiterating long-stated calls for allowing additional aid to get into Gaza. Quote, if there's no changes to their policy in their approaches, then there's going to have to be changes to ours, Kirby said. There are things that need to be done. There are too many civilians being killed, unquote. The demands for Israel to bring the conflict to a swift close were increasing across the political spectrum, with former President Donald Trump, the Republicans' presumptive nominee to face Biden this fall, saying Thursday that Israel was, quote, absolutely losing the PR war, and calling for a resolution to the bloodshed. Quote, get it over with and let's get back to peace and stop killing people. And that's a very simple statement, Trump told conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt. Quote, they have to get it done. Get it over with and get it over with fast, because we have to. You have to get back to normalcy and peace, unquote. Biden and Netanyahu also discussed Iranian threats against Israel, Kirby said. Earlier this week, Iranian leaders vowed to hit back after an airstrike widely blamed on Israel destroyed Iran's consulate in Syria, killing 12 people, including two elite Iranian generals. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said Wednesday the attack, quote, will not remain without answer, unquote. Biden also renewed his concerns about Netanyahu's plan to carry out an operation in the southern city of Rafah, where about 1.5 million displaced Palestinians are sheltering as Israel looks to eliminate Hamas following the militant group's deadly October 7th attack. Vice President Kamala Harris, Blinken, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan also joined the call. Still, the Biden administration proceeded apace with arms transfers and deliveries to Israel, many of which were approved years ago, but had been only partially or not at all fulfilled. Just this week on Monday, the Democrat administration's daily list of munitions transfers included the sale to Israel of more than 1,500-pound bombs and more than 1,000-pound bombs. Officials said those transfers were approved before the publication of the list on Monday. The day Israeli airstrikes hit a World Central KitchenAid convoy in Gaza, killing 7 of the group's employees, and that they fell below the threshold for new congressional notification. Also, they noted that the bombs are not for delivery to Israel until 2025. Now to the Iowa stories on the front page. Postpartum Medicaid extension to governor. Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau wrote this story, and the dateline is Des Moines. A bill headed to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk would extend Medicaid postpartum coverage to a year for new mothers who qualify, but remove prenatal and postpartum care for hundreds of other Iowans. House lawmakers passed the bill on Wednesday, along with a bill altering the rules for an anti-abortion pregnancy support program. The Medicaid bill takes advantage of a federal program giving states the option to extend Medicaid coverage from the 60 days currently required by law to 12 months. The option was made available in the 2021 American Rescue Plan Act, and Iowa is one of the last states to enact the extension. The maximum income to qualify for coverage would be lowered, though, making some families who are currently eligible for prenatal care under Medicaid no longer eligible. The income limit for Medicaid eligibility is higher for pregnant women and infants, and the number varies by state. Iowa currently provides birth and postpartum Medicaid coverage for families making up to 375% of the federal poverty line, the highest eligibility limit of any state. The bill, Senate File 2251, would lower that limit to 215% of the federal poverty line, extending coverage for eligible mothers to 12 months after birth. The change would make Iowa's eligibility limit for prenatal and postpartum care around 13th in the nation. The new level would cover single mothers making up to $43,900 a year and a family of four making up to $67,100. That change would lead to around 1,300 women and 400 infants a month being no longer eligible for prenatal or postpartum care under Iowa's Medicaid program, according to analysis from the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Those 1,300 mothers would need to pay out of pocket for checkups and birth if they do not have private insurance. Around 2,700 women who would have otherwise lost postpartum coverage after 2 months would instead remain eligible for the full 12 months, the agency said. The changes would take effect on January 1st, and anyone who is pregnant and covered under Medicaid before that date would not lose their coverage. House lawmakers approved the proposal on Wednesday, moving the bill on to Reynolds, a Republican, for signature. The bill passed the House 70-25. 10 Democrats joined nearly all Republicans in voting for the measure, while 1 Republican and 24 Democrats voted no. Maternal health care experts have lobbied for years to extend the coverage, saying it will improve health outcomes for the women during a vulnerable period and address inequities in health care. Problems like postpartum depression, substance abuse, and some heart conditions can show up months after giving birth, proponents have said. Groups like the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the Iowa Hospital Association registered in favor of the bill. Reynolds proposed the bill at the beginning of the session, saying it would help new mothers who are struggling to make ends meet. A spokesperson for the governor did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Democrats want to keep current income eligibility. Lowering the income eligibility was an attempt to keep the program cost neutral while providing more coverage for low-income Iowans, Republicans said. Though the cost increase will be minimal by 2028, the changes are expected to cost the state around $6 million over the next 3 years, including one-time IT costs and an increase in infants moving from Medicaid to the Healthy and Well Kids of Iowa program, which has a higher eligibility limit. Democrats said they wanted to keep the current eligibility limit for pregnancy care under Medicaid while extending coverage to 12 months, arguing the state has the funds to cover everyone. An amendment offered by Democrats to keep the eligibility limit at 375% was voted down by Republicans. Extending the coverage at the current eligibility level would cost about $14 million over 4 years, according to bills proposed during the last legislative session. Democrats said the high cost of medical care to carry a pregnancy to term and give birth would be a burden on the thousands of women who will no longer qualify for Medicaid coverage under Iowa's program. They argued that Iowa should retain its distinction of having the most generous eligibility limit in the country. Representative Sharon Sue Steckman, a Democrat from Mason City, argued the bill changes would lower the income of OBGYNs in the state and worsen the state's maternal health care crisis. Quote, bills like this do not make Iowa a welcoming state, Steckman said. Quote, I guess it's not any good to be a shining example for all the other states on how to treat moms and children. We're going to go to the bottom of the pile again, unquote. Republican Representative Devon Wood of New Market, who managed the bill, said it would give vital help to low-income Iowans who need it the most, giving them 10 more months of coverage than they currently receive. She said new mothers who have mental health problems and substance abuse issues after 2 months are, quote, falling through the cracks and would be helped under the change. Quote, with the money that we have in our Medicaid program, we're only able to cover 60 days, and I absolutely want to see the most of this money go to the moms and babies who need it the absolute most for a longer period of time, Wood said. House lawmakers also passed a bill Wednesday to allow the State Department of Health and Human Services to independently administer a program set up to fund anti-abortion pregnancy support centers. The More Options for Maternal Support program was created by state lawmakers in 2022 to direct state funds to crisis pregnancy centers, which are non-medically licensed centers that provide education, support, and services for pregnant women. They are often run by religious organizations and discourage abortion. Opponents of the program argue the centers provide misleading information and are not bound by medical privacy laws and use fear tactics to dissuade patients from receiving abortions. The HHS department has failed to find an administrator for the program after multiple bid opportunities, and lawmakers hope the legislation will get the program up and running. The bill, Senate File 2252, would allow the HHS department to directly administer the program and change some of the requirements for a contractor to administer the program if the department chooses one. The bill passed the House along party lines on Wednesday. It is now eligible to be signed into law by Reynolds. Democrats said the centers misrepresent their medical expertise and give inaccurate information about abortion. Quote, "Why would we send taxpayer dollars to an organization that promotes medically dangerous misinformation as part of their pregnancy support services? That's a bad idea," said Representative Heather Mattson, a Democrat from Ankeny. Republicans argued that the medical services provided by the centers would be overseen by the state's medical boards and that the staff performing the procedures, like ultrasounds, have adequate training. Representative Michael Bergen, a Republican from Dorchester, said the bill keeps the requirements for contractors strong and gives the HHS department the oversight authority to ensure the centers are following the law. Quote, "We look at this being one more opportunity to provide support and benefits to expecting mothers in Iowa," he said. "They'll be there to provide counseling service and enhance that with other services that are available through referral processes to the communities," unquote. Iowa rescinds gender parity rule for government bodies. Backlash against diversity grows. Reynolds urges merit-based appointments. Story written by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, and it begins with a photograph of our Governor Kim Reynolds signing Senate File 2096 into law at the state capitol. And she's sitting on a big leather chair and writing at a desk. Dateline Des Moines. Government boards and commissions in Iowa are no longer required by state law to include an equal number of men and women, thanks to legislation signed into law Wednesday by our Governor Kim Reynolds. Reynolds, the state's first female governor, signed the legislation, which she proposed, during a ceremony at the governor's formal office at the Iowa Capitol. The law repeals the requirement that state and local boards and commissions be gender balanced, a requirement that's been in place since 1988. Iowa experts say repealing the state's gender balance requirement likely will result in fewer women serving on government boards and commissions, especially at the local level. Reynolds said as a state senator in 2009, she voted against an extension of the gender balance requirement for government boards and commissions because she believed it was unnecessary. Quote, "I believed then, as I still do now, that our focus should always be on appointing the most qualified people," Reynolds said at the bill signing ceremony. Quote, "And that includes engaged citizens with a genuine interest in serving their state or local government, as well as individuals with valuable experience that directly relates to that position," unquote. The legislation, Senate File 2096, passed both chambers of the Iowa legislature with only Republican support. Senator Chris Cornoyer, a Republican from LeClaire, celebrated the progress of women in various public arenas and encouraged Iowa women to serve on government boards and commissions. Cornoyer said it will be up to those bodies' leaders to choose new members who are most qualified and best represent the occupation they govern. Quote, "Our foremothers, who fought hard over many, many years to get us a seat at the table, whether it was the right to vote, Title IX, or countless other ways, are smiling today." Cornoyer said, quote, "They got us to the table, and it has been up to us to show that we belong there, and we have," unquote. The original requirement was proposed by then State Senator Jean Lloyd Jones, an Iowa City Democrat, who went on to co-found the organization 50-50 in 2020, which sought to create gender balance in the Iowa legislature by encouraging and helping more women seek election to the State House. That original proposal had broad bipartisan support in the legislature and was signed into law by then-Governor Terry Branstad, a Republican. According to research from the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University, 61% of county boards and commissions were gender balanced in 2022, and women held just 38% of seats and 26% of leadership positions. Karen Kudrowski, director of the Catt Center, said research shows the state's gender balance requirement did not produce a significant increase in the overall percentage of women serving on government boards, but did correlate with more widespread distribution of women on government boards. Quote, more boards are gender balanced, even as the total number of women serving has remained pretty much the same, Kudrowski said during a recent appearance on Iowa PBS Iowa Press. Quote, this demonstrates that the gender balance law really did work and that it incentivized local governments to make the effort to find women to serve on boards that might have been overwhelmingly male and to find men who would serve on boards that were traditionally overwhelmingly female, unquote. Kudrowski said she believes some local government leaders will continue to make an effort to keep boards gender balanced, but without the requirement, many will not. Quote, and I suspect, though, that what we will see is a retrenchment where there will be fewer boards that are gender balanced and potentially fewer women in leadership positions on those boards, Kudrowski said. Court ruling. Earlier this year, a federal judge ruled Iowa's gender balance requirement for the State Judicial Nominating Commission, the panel that sends Reynolds recommendations for judicial nominations, is unconstitutional. The organization that brought that lawsuit, Pacific Legal Foundation, celebrated Wednesday's bill signing, calling the repealed gender balance requirement, quote, gender discrimination, and saying it created a hurdle that potential government board members had to clear before being considered based on their qualifications. Quote, the 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection under the law, and now Iowa's laws fulfill that promise to the board and commission applicants of either gender, Kylene Lundgren, the legal policy manager at Pacific Legal Foundation, said in a statement. The new law takes effect on July 1st. We turn now to the Nation and World page of the Courier, and we have the story with the headline, Presidential Records Act Argument Rejected, a Win for Prosecutors. This story was written by Eric Tucker of the Associated Press. Dateline Washington. A federal judge refused Thursday to throw out the classified documents prosecution against Donald Trump, turning aside defense arguments that a decades-old law permitted the former president to retain the sensitive records after he left office. Lawyers for Trump cited a 1978 statute known as the Presidential Records Act in demanding that the case, one of the four against the presumptive Republican nominee, be tossed out before trial. That law requires presidents, upon leaving office, to turn over presidential records to the federal government, but permits them to retain purely personal papers. Prosecutors on Special Counsel Jack Smith's team countered that the law had no relevance to a case concerning the mishandling of classified documents and said the records Trump is alleged to have hoarded at his Mar-a-Lago estate were unquestionably presidential records, not personal files, and therefore had to be returned to the government when Trump left the White House in January of 2021. U.S. District Court Judge Eileen Cannon, who heard arguments on the matter last month, permitted the case to proceed in a three-page order that rejected the Trump team's claims. She wrote that the 40-count indictments against Trump makes, quote, no reference to the Presidential Records Act, nor does it rely on that statute for purposes of stating an offense, unquote. The ruling represents a modest win for Smith's team, which has been trying to push the prosecution forward to trial this year, while also expressing growing frustration, including earlier this week, with Cannon's oversight of the case. Other Trump motions to dismiss the indictment remain unresolved by the judge. The trial date is in flux, and additional legal disputes have slowed the progress of the case. In Thursday's ruling, Cannon also defended an order from last month that asked lawyers for both sides to formulate potential jury instructions and to respond to two different scenarios in which she appeared to be continuing to entertain Trump's presidential records argument. The order drew a sharp rebuke from Smith's team, with prosecutors in a filing this week calling the premises she laid out, quote, fundamentally flawed, and warned that they were prepared to appeal if she pushed ahead with jury instructions that they considered wrong. And now, listeners, we'd just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 5th, on IRIS, that's I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and the print handicapped. And now, let's listen to this message.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. This first one was published on the Storm Lake Times Pilot opinion page, written by Jen Olson, and the title is GOP House Hardliners Again Threaten Farm Bill. Even when Speaker of the House Mike Johnson finds enough bailing wire to lash together the votes needed to pass the split, almost 6 months late, 2023 federal budget, it's little more than a signal to some of his GOP colleagues to heat up the tar and gather the feathers to embarrass the Louisianan at the moment of his victory. That might explain Johnson's perpetual frown, even when he wins difficult votes like the two March spending bills. He's pilloried by Republican hardliners for working with Democrats to secure passage. Isn't that how split government must work if, unlike under the three previous Republican speakers, Boehner, Ryan, and McCarthy, it's to work at all? Not to the hardliners. Their message to the speaker is loud, clear, and threatening. Stop depending on Dems to make government, or at least this government, work. And the hardliners are having an impact on some of their House GOP colleagues. When the initial half of the budget bill was approved in early March, 132 Republicans joined 207 Democrats to give Johnson a solid 339-85 win, well over the two-thirds majority required by his sly suspension of the rules vote. 2 weeks later, however, 29 fewer GOP members voted for the second part of the split bill to leave Johnson with an onion-skin-thin triumph that barely cleared the required two-thirds hurdle. The winning margin, however, was again supplied by the Democrats. If the second vote is evidence that the speaker is leaking power, the remainder of the legislative year promises to be an even nastier GOP brawl than 2023, when Republicans tossed out Speaker Kevin McCarthy, then threw spitballs at each other during the three-week, three-ring circus that followed. From an ag policy perspective, any fight in the House GOP caucus guarantees continued slow, if any, action on the 2023, now 2024, Farm Bill. But 2024 appears to be slouching toward 2025, with some ag state Republicans. Witness Iowa GOP Senator Joni Ernst, who told AgriPulse on March 24th that she sees little chance for a farm bill this calendar year, but hopes for better chances in 2025, unquote. Ernst didn't complete the thought because she didn't have to. Her better chances in 2025 suggest a possible Republican sweep of November's general election to take the House, Senate, and White House. That view is not shared by House Ag Committee Chairman Glenn Thompson. 2 days before Ernst's comment, the Pennsylvania Republican told another AgriPulse reporter that a 2024 farm bill was, quote, becoming more realistic, and that his team is waiting on some final analysis from the Congressional Budget Office before moving forward with a House draft. Moreover, Thompson sounded much more open to Democratic additions to the draft than most of his Republican partners. In fact, he added, noted AgriPulse that this team was also working on baking bipartisan proposals into the legislation. Yes, he said it, the B word. Perhaps even more remarkable was that after he let gulp, bipartisan slip his lips, Thompson wasn't vaporized by lightning. The earth didn't open up and swallow him whole, and the Capitol dome didn't crumble into dust. House Democrats, fresh off their able assistance to pass both budget bills, the second one included an extra $1 billion to the WIC, Women, Infants, and Children Food Assistance Program, are ready. But, warned Representative Sanford Bishop, a Georgia Democrat and the ranking member of the Appropriations Ag FDA Subcommittee, House Republicans can drop any plans to cut food assistance if they expect help in this committee to fund any farm bill. That's good advice, given Speaker Johnson's slippery hold on his increasingly mutinous majority. It also turns up the burner under Johnson's already hot seat. Does he want Dems to help pass a farm bill now, or would he prefer to gamble on November's election? Next, from the New York Times, editorial writer Paul Krugman. The title is, Will MAGA Republicans Block Baltimore's Rebuilding? And we begin with a photograph taken of the broken bridge laying on the bow of that giant container ship which hit the pier, causing its demise. Now to the editorial. Soon after, a huge container ship struck Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, bringing it down. President Biden pledged that the federal government would, quote, pay the entire cost of reconstructing the bridge. This would clearly be the right thing to do, not just to help the state of Maryland, but also to limit the economic damage from a disaster that has blocked both a major road artery and a major port. Among other things, the Port of Baltimore plays a key role in both exports of coal and trade in farm and construction equipment, so the bridge disaster will have direct adverse effects on the heartland as well as the East Coast. And if America were still the same country that enacted the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956, passed with overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress, and signed into law by a Republican president, which gave rise to our interstate system, there would be little question that Congress would approve funding soon after it returns from Easter recess. But we aren't that country anymore. Biden will probably be able to get funds for rebuilding, but it's by no means a sure thing. The rise of MAGA Republicans is only part of the problem. I've seen several people citing the response to the 2007 collapse of the Interstate 35 bridge in Minnesota as an example of what things were like in a better political era. Indeed, within days, Congress voted unanimously to provide $250 million in aid. But that was a one-off. The Minnesota bridge collapse highlighted the decaying state of America's infrastructure, and one might have expected the disaster to lead to real action, but it didn't. President Barack Obama pleaded with Congress to approve broad increases in infrastructure spending and was able to sign a highway bill in 2015, but for the most part, he was stymied by GOP opposition. As president, Donald Trump repeatedly promised to revamp America's infrastructure. Quote, "It's infrastructure week," became a running joke, but never delivered. Major action on infrastructure didn't happen until late 2021 with the enactment of the bipartisan infrastructure law, which, despite the name, received only 13 Republican votes in the House. And that was with Democrats in full control of Congress. It's not foolish to worry that MAGA hardliners will block aid to Maryland in much the same way that they've blocked aid to Ukraine. But again, MAGA is only part of the problem. Let's talk for a minute about why it took 14 years after the Minnesota bridge collapse for us to finally take major action on infrastructure. Extreme partisanship, which took hold long before Trump took control of the GOP, is part of the answer. It was clear through most of the Obama years that Republicans wanted to prevent good things from happening on a Democratic president's watch. Under Obama, GOP legislators freezed federal spending after they took control of the House, supposedly because they were worried about government debt, only to open up the taps once Trump took office. There was also an element of reflexive opposition to government spending in general, no matter how obvious the need. Mitch McConnell, as Senate Majority Leader, didn't do much to oppose Trump, but he did put the brakes on infrastructure spending. Finally, to the extent that Trump had anything like an infrastructure plan, it was very, well, Trumpian. Even before he took office, I predicted that he wouldn't actually do much to build infrastructure because he and his associates clearly weren't interested in producing a clean plan for government investment. Instead, they were floating a roundabout scheme involving tax credits that wouldn't have generated significant new investment, but probably would have offered huge opportunities for cronyism and corruption. The history here is reason enough to worry about rebuilding in Baltimore, even if the bridge collapse hadn't been caught up in culture war politics. But of course, it has. MAGA politicians and media figures wasted no time after the bridge collapse trying to cast blame on the usual suspects, including funds meant to be spent on green energy and, in particular, diversity initiatives. In the immediate wake of the Key Bridge collapse, a Republican state legislator from Utah replied to a post on X disparaging a member of the Maryland Port Commission, writing, quote, "This is what happens when you have governors who prioritize diversity over the well-being and security of citizens." A Republican former state legislator from Florida posted a video clip of the Key Bridge collapsing with the caption, "DEI did this." Baltimore's Mayor Brandon Scott has been a special target on X, the site formerly known as Twitter, for no apparent reason other than the fact that he's black. As the New Republic's Greg Sargent points out, some of the MAGA reaction to the bridge collapse is reminiscent of Trump's behavior during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, when he whined about bailouts for states that didn't support him politically. So will partisanship and conspiracy theorizing get in the way of rebuilding the Key Bridge? I'd like to dismiss that risk. But not that long ago, if you had asked me, I wouldn't have expected Republicans to stonewall aid to Ukraine either. So this is no time to be complacent. Let's stay in the New York Times and read one more about the bridge collapse. This one is titled "Stuck Ships and Supply Chain Inflation," and was written by Paul Krugman. It has been a week since the Dolly, a container ship, struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. It's still stuck there, and the images remain amazing, in part because the vessel is so huge compared with what's left of the bridge. How could planners not have realized that operating super ships in the harbor's confined water posed a risk? And with the ship and pieces of the bridge blocking the harbor entry, the Port of Baltimore remains closed. How big a deal is that for the economy? Well, it would have been quite a big deal if it had happened in late 2021 or early 2022, when global supply chains were under a lot of pressure. Remember when all those ships were steaming back and forth in front of Los Angeles, waiting for a berth? It's less important now. Pre-Dolly Baltimore was only the 17th busiest U.S. port, and there's apparently enough spare capacity that most of the cargoes that would normally have passed through Baltimore can be diverted to other East Coast ports. The Dolly is no Ever Given, the ship that blocked the Suez Canal when it ran aground in 2021. Still, global supply chains don't have as much slack as they did, say, last summer, after the pandemic disruptions were mostly a thing of the past. Because Baltimore isn't the only problem. The Panama Canal is operating at reduced capacity because a historic drought, probably in part of a consequence of climate change, has limited the supply of water to fill the canal's locks. Elsewhere, the Houthis have been firing missiles at ships entering or leaving the Red Sea, that is, heading to or from the Suez Canal. Presumably, as a result of these and other problems, the New York Fed's widely cited Index of Global Supply Chain Pressure, while still not flashing the red lights, it was showing in the winter of 2021-22, has worsened significantly since last August. And given what we know about the causes of the inflation surge of 2021-22, this worsening makes me feel a bit nervous. I think it's fair to say that a great majority of economists were caught flat-footed one way or another by inflation developments over the past 3 years. Along with many others, I failed to predict the big initial run-up in inflation. But even most economists who got that part right appear in retrospect to have been right for the wrong reasons, because they failed to anticipate the, quote, immaculate disinflation of 2023. Inflation plunged, even though there was no recession, and the high unemployment some claimed would be necessary to get inflation down never materialized. A side remark, official measures of inflation were somewhat hot in the first 2 months of 2024, but much of this probably reflects the so-called January effect, which is actually spread out over January and February, in which many companies raised their prices with the coming of a new year. The Federal Reserve and many independent economists expect disinflation to resume in the months ahead. So what explains the swift rise and fall of inflation? Way back in July 2021, White House economists argued that we were in a situation resembling the surge in inflation that began in 1946. That recovery from COVID had created conditions similar to the early post-war period of pent-up demand and disrupted supply chains. The post-war inflation surge ended relatively quickly, after 2 years, without an extended period of high unemployment. In retrospect, that analysis looks spot on, since pretty much the same thing seems to have happened in the latest inflation cycle. Following Mike Consal of the Roosevelt Institute, who has just joined the Biden administration, there's a plot of annual changes in core inflation, measured as consumer prices excluding food, which is the best number available back to the 1940s, against the unemployment rate. As you can see, 2023 looks like the late 1940s, not as inflation pessimists predicted, like the Volcker disinflation of the early 1980s. This all makes a lot of sense, and until recently made me feel rather comfortable about the prospects for a soft landing, inflation falling to an acceptable level with unemployment staying low. But if you think supply chain disruptions were the main driver of inflation and easing of these disruptions the main driver of disinflation, you have to be worried about the effects of a renewed worsening of the supply chain situation. Now, supply chain problems today aren't remotely as bad as they were in 2021-22, If the Dolly disaster had occurred back then, it really would have been a collapsed bridge too far. At least according to the New York Fed measure, we've actually been experiencing a stretch of below normal supply pressure, and all that has happened is a return to normal. This might not have much adverse effect on inflation, but I'm not as sure about this as I'd like. Supply chains are making me nervous again. Now from the Des Moines Register, Iowa isn't getting tough on immigration. This bill is all politics. Listening to Iowa Republicans talk about illegal immigration, their horror at how President Joe Biden directs federal resources and policies with regard to borders is palpable. Just as obvious, though, is the strength of belief among Republicans nationwide that contrasting Biden with Donald Trump on immigration is among their most promising paths to victory in November's general election. It is in that context that Governor Kim Reynolds is poised to sign into law a bill that sounds tough, but almost certainly will change nothing for, at minimum, many months. It will change nothing because it plainly is incompatible with federal law, regardless of advocates' insistence that states are threatened by an invasion. A federal appeals court has placed a nearly identical Texas law on hold for exactly that reason. Besides the practical impotence of the bill, its operation, if it eventually took effect, would not make Iowa better. It would create more work and potentially expense for local law enforcement, and it would punitively deny rights to migrants without documentation. Iowa should have left well enough alone. Once the bill is signed, a legal challenge and judicial injunction should follow promptly. This isn't a real solution to immigration challenges. Senate File 2340 creates a crime called illegal reentry. Migrants who have previously been deported or denied entry into the United States could be arrested if they're found in Iowa. The penalties are geared toward getting defendants out of the country. The criminal cases can be dropped in favor of deportation if the defendant agrees, and removal is required condition of sentencing after conviction. The legal problems this poses are considerable, but it's worth weighing practical concerns at the outset. Undocumented immigrants' distrust of law enforcement would presumably increase if state law empowers and encourages them to enforce this law. And would people who do have permission to be in the country be more likely to be questioned over their status? Do local police need more work? The bill requires that an official be designated to ensure that people ordered to leave Iowa for a port of entry actually do so. This provision strains the Republican "every state is a border state" mantra. Quote, "The cost to transport an individual to a port of entry is unknown. Although the fiscal impact cannot be estimated, it may be significant," unquote. Nonpartisan analysts wrote about the Iowa bill. No lobbyist representing Iowa law enforcement organizations registered in favor of the bill. Muzaffar Christie, a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, told the Associated Press that, quote, "to train a bunch of state officers in the field of enforcement in which they have zero background and zero training is an operational headache," unquote. As for the legal side, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 2012 that states are not permitted under the Constitution to freelance their own immigration enforcement schemes, turning back an aggressive Arizona law. U.S. District Court David Ezra last month ruled that Texas's law suffered from the same defect as Arizona's. Texas is arguing that it has been, quote, invaded, and gets more leeway under Article 1 of the Constitution as a result. Ezra was unimpressed, writing that, quote, "surges in immigration do not constitute an invasion within the meaning of the Constitution." The reasons for leaving immigration policy in the federal government's hands are many. As the Texas law bounced through the court system, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor noted that its implementation would, quote, "disrupt sensitive foreign relations, frustrate the protection of individuals fleeing persecution, hamper active federal enforcement efforts, undermine federal agencies' ability to detect and monitor imminent security threats, and deter non-citizens from reporting abuse or trafficking. The question of whether Texas can eventually enforce its law is now before a federal appeals court and could eventually go back to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's unlikely that any such law will be allowed to take effect anytime soon. For now, in other words, Iowa's Senate File 2340 amounts to posturing more than policy. Quote, "Extraordinary times require extraordinary measures," Representative Steve Holt, a Denison Republican, said on the Iowa House floor as he acknowledged the complexity of the legal landscape. But even if the Supreme Court overturns its 2012 ruling in the Arizona cases or buys into the idea that invasion justifies a bill like Iowa's, this approach is still not prudent. Those unhappy with how President Joe Biden handles immigration should vote him out of office or insist that Congress pass laws to restrict his discretion. Those remedies are in line with the Constitution. What's not helpful is challenging the White House's authority with a bill that does nothing now and could make things worse later. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 5th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.